Time so we can end on time if people eat early supper. My name is Mary Carlson, and in case you're wondering, the session here is Living with AIDS. There's a conflict management session next door, which would be awfully nice, too. As some of you have heard, I'm a social worker, and I've been practicing for the last 4 years at a hospital in Minneapolis with people with HIV infection in an outpatient setting, and also with people and their families who have experienced full-blown AIDS and are needing to be hospitalized. So I've really sort of done both in and outpatient care with these folks. You need to hear from the outset that I'm a social worker, and I'm not a physician, and I'm not an epidemiologist, and I'm not a nurse, and I'm not a scientist. And really what I'd like to talk about today and throughout the next week is what I call AIDS 201, which is sort of the larger and bigger impact of HIV infection and AIDS on the people who have it and on us as caregivers and on society. So I am assuming some basic knowledge on your part of HIV infection. I am going to use some slides today to start out with some basic definitions. You'll notice on your chairs that you've got a glossary of definitions. I wanted to thank the Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York City for putting that out. They gave me permission to copy it. I also want you to know that what I'm speaking from is my experience in Minnesota. And I know probably a lot of you are from the Middle West. We have not had the experience yet that the East Coast and the West Coast have had with AIDS and HIV. So I speak out of my experience, but I'll certainly be happy to entertain questions or comments from people who know perhaps about the epidemic from other parts of the country or other parts of the world. We know it's a worldwide phenomenon. At Holden, we're pretty easygoing presenters here, so if at any time you don't understand a concept or a word or a definition, please interrupt me.
Slides are over there.
Yeah, right. Slides are over here. So. Becky, why don't you be over here by the lights, see the lights. I'm an informal presenter, and I really don't mind being interrupted at any point, so please feel free. What we're going to try to do today is begin to grasp some of the complexity of the psychosocial, in other words, non-medical, non-physical issues that arise for people who are infected with the HIV virus and for those who have developed full-blown AIDS. It's a very difficult topic because it combines, if you think about it, sex, death, politics, and a little religion. And aren't those the four topics we were always told not to discuss in public? My mother would be proud, I'm sure, see me discussing it. But the four ideas really are brought together in AIDS, so it makes it a sort of a sexy but a very difficult topic to talk about. So I appreciate that folks are willing to be here. I certainly also hope to be able to learn from many of you because this is a fairly new epidemic in our country, and all of us are learning as time goes by, myself included. Lest we get too serious, because as soon as I'm done with any discussion of AIDS, everybody's face is like this. It's like talking about grief and death and dying, and so it's hard to kind of get up about it. Several of the people with AIDS I know well, as I talked to them about doing these presentations at Holden, said, make sure you build in some humor. Make sure you talk about the importance of humor and coping with this disease along with many others. Any of you staying 2 weeks can come next week and we'll talk about humor and illness. That's not today. But you did see some comic strips of Doonesbury on your chairs. A lot of the people with AIDS I know found them quite humorous. So I think it's important that we keep in mind the humorous aspect. On the other hand, lest we get too flip and lest we get too caught up with technical terms and statistics, which we're going to go over with the slides in just a minute, I'd like to read for you a reflection on Psalm 102 that one of the people with AIDS I have been caring for a couple years and who is still living with AIDS has written, and he agreed to let me share this with folks. So I'd like to start out with that. It's a reflection on Psalm 102 by David. First, the psalm. Of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you endure. They will wear out like a garment. You change them like raiment, and they pass away. But you are the same, and your years have no end. The children of God shall dwell secure. Their posterity shall be established before thee. The mild winter seemed to be ending as days lengthened and temperatures stayed bearable. Winter's threat seemed past, and the change to spring's renewal seemed just a month or so ahead. Yet the winter was just beginning in my lungs as tender pink tissue was quickly covered by a blanket of white pneumonia, and fevers chilled my body, and painful diagnosis swept like a blizzard through my soul. With my immune system permanently altered, I became sickened by a life-threatening AIDS infection. For many days, I wondered where the hope of spring had gone as the first needles of medication weakened me further, raising and maintaining my fevers to 104 plus. Yet with the prayers of loving family, friends, a lover, and two wonderful clergy, with the cards and flowers that arrived almost every day, with the guts of a doctor willing to try a non-FDA approved drug, and with the faith that God could and would heal me, my fevers came down. The medication began shoveling out my lungs and my body and soul strengthened. I soon was able to be up and dressed and look out my hospital window to witness the promised springtime. The naked gray frames of trees became clothed in tender new leaves. Once sleeping lilacs awakened to bud and blossom, and fresh green grass covered last year's shortcuts across the park. Like the trees, grass, and lilacs, by the grace of God, I survived my winter, grew healthy in my spring, and enjoyed a splendid sun and water-filled summer. Now God's earth changes again. Summer's shortcuts are clearly trod, and in fall colors, God begins to clothe the earth. These changes no longer anger or frighten me, for the love of God which sustains me endures forever and gives me the promise of springtime, renewal, and growth in any season. From David, for all of you. Okay. A quick change of pace, and those of you who are sitting right there might need to move a little. We're going to do a few little slides so that we can sort of come to the discussion we have about AIDS from about the same place. Maybe we could hit the lights. And my assumption is we don't have any of the hearing impaired folks here. Is this correct?
No.
And no interpreter?
None yet.
Okay.
There's lights.
Yeah, I think the ones behind you are the ones we're supposed to use. And then if someone could just flip on the projector in the back, please. People can see okay? As all of you know, AIDS stands for the Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. What's important about that is to realize it is a syndrome. It is not one disease, but instead a vast number of diseases that can give somebody the diagnosis of AIDS.
Mary, can you move yourself?
Oh, yeah. As long as I can see just a little bit. I think I probably can. How's that? Better? I'm not
Sorry, look around.
Okay. We'll see if I see my nose. I think that's good. The routes of transmission for the human immunodeficiency virus, which is the name of the virus now that everybody in the world has agreed to use. There have been a number of names for it over the years. Are four particular routes of transmission. One is through sexual contact with an infected person. Two is through injection directly into the veins, either by use of illicit drugs or accidental injection, perhaps by a healthcare worker. Three is the transfusion into the body of infected blood or blood components. And four is the passing of the virus from the mother to her child in the process of birth or in utero. This is a popular slide in Minnesota, shows a number of routes that AIDS is not spread by. The most popular in Minnesota, of course, is mosquitoes. Swimming pools also. But early on in the epidemic, many people were afraid that mosquitoes carried it, and I heard the public health director for the state of Minnesota say if they did carry the virus, Minnesota would have been decimated long ago. These are some of the older names of the virus, and you can see on the bottom the human immunodeficiency virus is the name that has been agreed upon. This sounds a little bit scientific, but the upshot of the definition for AIDS as given by the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta means that we need to have figured out that there's no other reason for someone's immune system to have broken down. In other words, there's no other cause for immune deficiency. And that there's a presence of an opportunistic disease, OD, which is simply an infection or a cancer that takes the opportunity to invade a body whose immune system has broken down. And these are bugs that are flying around affecting all of us at any time, but most of us can fight them off. It's important to note in September of 87, the CDC expanded its definition for AIDS to include HIV encephalopathy, the HIV wasting syndrome, or SLIM disease, which is what AIDS is known as in most other parts of the world. Because without the sophisticated diagnostic tools we have in this country, many people just see that folks sometimes lose up to 30 to 40% of their body weight, and they call it the SLIM disease. And also including a presumptive diagnosis of certain opportunistic diseases that particularly might be too difficult to perform a procedure on to certainly diagnose somebody, say an open lung biopsy on somebody who's extremely weak. But if other criteria are in place, those people also fall into the category of AIDS. In September of 87, then, the number of people included in the AIDS definition in this country increased by quite a bit. The United States Public Health Service now estimates that up to 1.5 million people in this country are infected with the HIV virus, keeping in mind that a number of people are infected with the virus but don't know it. They're not sick. They feel like most of us in this room feel. It's also important to realize AIDS is a global epidemic, and we tend to get in this country quite focused on just ourselves and on San Francisco and on New York and on Minneapolis and Chicago. But in fact, AIDS has been reported in 139 out of, I believe, 156 countries in the world. These are some of the fairly old statistics. The important thing to remember about these, too, is that the rates of reporting vary dramatically from various countries. A number of countries, for political or scientific or social reasons, don't report or can't report the actual number of people with AIDS. Is this in focus okay for folks? World Health Organization, or WHO, has embarked on a massive worldwide effort to combat AIDS, and they estimate that currently there are probably 10 million people in the world now infected with HIV. I think there have been to date a little over 100,000 official cases reported. 99% of the people with AIDS in the world, in the U.S.,
do you want me to focus
this? Yeah, would you try it up there? That'd be great. 99% of people with AIDS in our country are adults. It's interesting to be looking at the transmission categories. These are statistics through February of 1988. The statistics have changed slightly. For people who are homosexual or bisexual males, in 88 it was 65% of the people with AIDS in our country. As of April of this year, it's 61%, so that has decreased some. Those who are heterosexual intravenous drug abusers make up 20% now and not 17% of the people with AIDS in the country. So you can see where some percentages are decreasing and some are increasing. People who are both homosexual males and intravenous drug abusers make up 7% of the people with AIDS. Hemophiliacs, 1%. Heterosexual transmission accounts for 4%. Transfusion-related AIDS diagnosis is 2%, and undetermined is about 3%. Undetermined usually means it's people who either died before they were able to figure out what the risk behaviors were, or they refused to tell, or they weren't able to let people know for some reason. So we look at the average age of people diagnosed with AIDS. It's somewhere in the early 30s, about age 32 for both men and for women. U.S. AIDS cases in the last 10 years approximately. What's important about this is to realize that by 1992, we expect 365,000 cases of AIDS in this country alone. As of April of this year, we had just over 91,000. So that's assuming, a quadrupling of cases in the next 2 years. In the year 1992, it's expected in that year alone we will have 60,000 deaths of AIDS. We've currently, since the beginning of the epidemic, had about 45,000 deaths. At any one time, about half the people who've been diagnosed with AIDS have died. It remains constant, right around 50%, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. There are differences in methods of transmission depending on a person's race or ethnicity that are important for us, particularly as white folks in this country, to keep aware of. And this is a fact that doesn't get much attention in the media. But in In the population of whites, the bulk of people who are white who have AIDS, 78%, are homosexual or bisexual males. However, if we look at people who are black, homosexual and bisexual males make up about 38% of the population with AIDS. Another 38% is intravenous drug abusers, which compares to about 6% in whites. Same kind of percentage, before I go on to women, is seen in Hispanic populations, that 44% of the people with AIDS are homosexual or bisexual male, remember, as compared to 78% in the white population. And in Hispanics, about 39% are intravenous drug abusers. So it doesn't have to do with who you are, but it has to do with what you do, how you get AIDS. Women make up about 8% of the total AIDS cases thus far in the country. Transmission categories for women, more than 50% of the women with AIDS are intravenous drug abusers. Another one-third of women with AIDS are partners of intravenous drug abusers or bisexual males. So more than two-thirds of the women with AIDS in this country have contracted it because of intravenous drug abuse, either themselves or their partners of people who use drugs. Again, the impact how the virus is transmitted is connected to race and ethnicity. For women, 55% of the people with AIDS who are women are black, 24% are white, 20% are Hispanic, which means that three-quarters of the people, women with AIDS in this country, are black or Hispanic. It's interesting also to know that the transfusion rate for heterosexual transmission rate for heterosexuals who are black or Hispanic women is 12 times the rate that for that of white women. Also, a very sad fact is that usually estimates are for somebody diagnosed with AIDS, they have about 18 months from diagnosis to time of death. That's an average across the country. For a black woman with AIDS diagnosis, the average is 7 months. Obviously, that has a lot to do with social and economic and political influences in our country. Now, if we look at children, children in this country currently make up 1% of the total cases of people with AIDS. Most children are diagnosed by age 1 year, as you can see by the graph. Mainly that's because children who are in the further along age group mostly are hemophiliacs or children who had received a blood transfusion prior to March of 85, when our blood was tested in this country. So most children are diagnosed up to 1 year of age. Transmission categories for children have everything to do with their parents being at risk for AIDS. More than 50% of children with AIDS have mothers who are intravenous drug users or partners of intravenous drug abusers. For children, 5% of the children with AIDS are hemophiliacs, 14% got AIDS through blood transfusion, and this will certainly, we expect, go down now that the blood is being tested. And similar to women, as we look at race and ethnicity, 53% of children with AIDS are black, 24% are white, and 23% are Hispanic, which real closely mirror the women's statistics. So again, about three-quarters of the children with AIDS in this country are black or Hispanic. We get the lights, and maybe somebody would just leave the fan on for a couple minutes. Any questions or comments or profound insights on the basis of a few statistics to start out? A shy group. Question?
No, a question, just a comment. Yeah. I read a very provocative article in Atlantic Monthly on heterosexual the effect of heterosexual activity and AIDS. It was a cover article. And it mentioned that the comparison to hepatitis B and transmission patterns. That's about a year and a half old article, I think, or 2 years. Has there been more updated information on that, those patterns?
I'm sure there's been a lot. I'm honestly not familiar with the most recent data on it. I know that certainly hepatitis B and AIDS have been compared from very early on in the patterns of infection. There is a lot of discussion in the healthcare community about how much easier it really is to get hepatitis B through an accidental needle stick or some sort of healthcare-related accident than AIDS, and there are some statistics on that which I don't have. But otherwise, if anybody else has them, Barbara, anything you know about? Okay.
But the implication was that at some point in time there may be a real explosion. Growth.
Hepatitis?
No, AIDS.
Oh, and AIDS.
Yeah.
No, I don't doubt that. And all STDs right now are on the increase in most parts of the country. Sexually transmitted diseases, not just AIDS, but many others are on the increase too. Yeah. Let's go a little bit. Yeah.
One comment, I thought it was really significant that the gay man had a drop in their statistics. And I've seen them being really responsible and doing a lot of education.
They certainly have taken the lead in this country to educate themselves and also in terms of caring for each other, providing services and volunteer efforts and so forth. I think what is scary about that is that gay men in general are people who probably are pretty well educated and can read and write, and they have a cohesive community in this country and have talked to each other. So their numbers of new infection are already dropping dramatically. But the numbers of new infection among people who are intravenous drug users, people who are illiterate, people who don't speak our language, people who are marginally intelligent, whatever we might want to talk about, that's going to be a more difficult population, I think, to reach in terms of our education, and that's some of what we saw already.
Along those lines, I've read articles that another one of the groups that's increasing are the teenagers.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of invulnerable, and
sure.
They don't think this is going to happen to them, even though they're getting a lot of education on AIDS.
Yeah. Do most people come from states where schools are now mandating AIDS education? No. I don't want to ask what state that is. Minnesota mandates it down to the 5th grade or 4th grade, I think.
Washington State has mandated it.
Washington, Oregon has.
Oregon does,
yeah.
That.
We had one community, which shall remain unnamed, north of the cities, that school board refused to go along with the Department of Education for the state, and they will not have any AIDS education in their schools anywhere through high school. So there's being a big debate now in the state, some protests about that and so forth. There was one community who decided against. Yeah.
One thing that I've always noticed with all this AIDS education is the reference to ethnicity and race. I don't understand the purpose of that, and it seems to be increasing and fueling prejudice in our area of the country, in Southern California, and I find that to be a real source of concern for us in the Christian community to keep a handle on it.
That's right. It's extremely disturbing if those statistics are presented in certain ways,
and
it's very difficult to present them, you're right, so that it doesn't sound like because people are black or Hispanic they're getting AIDS more, and it has to do with what color they are, and therefore we should stay away from them and we should not help them and we should, you know, use that as a bias and increasing racism. The point is very, very well taken. I think the point of emphasizing that, at least within the white community, on the good side, would be to encourage us to look at the policies of this country, economic, social, educational, that allow that sort of rampant increase of disease in certain populations. Now, most people aren't going to read carefully through those layers of implication, and that's so that you've made a very good point. It's really true.
Well, that also speaks to the whole thing of there being risk behaviors rather than risk groups. You know, they've even changed how they talk about that.
Yeah.
I mean, necessarily being gay doesn't have to put you in a risk group.
Mm-hmm.
It's determined by risk behavior.
Yeah. Language is very important in the whole conversation about AIDS. One definition I put up here is PWA, which is person with AIDS. People with AIDS do not want to be referred to as victims. And that's a very, very critical piece of language we need to talk about. But it's the same. Language issues anywhere are really important to look at and how we're presenting our material and what we're talking about. That's right. Anything else at this point? My wish for Holden Village is that someday we'll be able to have a person with AIDS or many people with AIDS at the village, because I feel a little inadequate and inept sitting here talking about what it's like to have AIDS. In the absence of somebody up here with HIV infection, at least that I'm aware of at this time, and maybe we will have somebody here at some point, I'd like to use a case example of somebody I've worked with for a long time, different from David, who wrote the poem, to illustrate some of the psychosocial or sort of bigger life aspects that people need to live with who have the diagnosis of AIDS. I'm going to talk a little bit about Mick, and then I'd like you to do some thinking as I'm talking about what parts of his life and the lives of people around him are being affected. Sort of looking at these psychosocial areas I have on the board, not in any particular order, except sort of alphabetically, which is why spiritual is sort of down here in the bottom. When I make presentations, I always say it's not that that's the least important. In fact, it probably should be at the top, by all rights. But we have behavioral, economic, emotional, ethical / moral, legal, psychological, social, and spiritual aspects of this disease for people. So if you sort of keep those areas of life in mind as I'm telling you a little about Mick, and then we'll have some conversation about that. Mick is a 34-year-old white gay male, and I use a white gay male because in Minnesota, 90% of our people with AIDS are white gay males, so that is most of my experience. It's also in the country now, as we saw, about 61% of the people with AIDS, so that is the reason I use this example. Mick's been employed by the United States government post office. He currently lives with his partner, Rob, in a home that Rob is buying. They've been together about 4 years. Rob and Mick have been pretty separate from the gay community in Minneapolis because they never were real social people, and they were kind of shy and loners, so they've been kind of happy to be by themselves and fairly separate from the social community. Mick's father is deceased for a number of years. His mother is quite disabled and lives in a small town north of Duluth in Minnesota. He has a sister and a brother. They both also live up north in the same small town, so he was the one who left the small town and came to the city. Only Mick's sister knows that he's gay, and she doesn't know his HIV status or the fact that he has full-blown AIDS either.
Mary?
Yeah.
Is there a tape recorder or something going on?
Yes.
I'm having a real hard time concentrating.
Thanks, yes. Appreciate that. I get so into it I don't hear other distractions, so that's probably good. Thank you to Jackie. Only Mick's sister knows he's gay, and she doesn't know his disease status at this point at all. So Mom and his brother don't know anything. Mick was diagnosed HIV positive in late 1987. He was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS about a year later, in December of 88, this last year. The diagnosis was given because he was diagnosed as having cryptosporidium, which is one of the weird diseases people with AIDS get, most of which a social worker can't even pronounce, because toxoplasmosis and cryptosporidium, not words that I'm used to using in my profession usually. Rob has tested negative for HIV 3 different times, but he finds himself wanting to test about every 3 months because he's always anxious that he's going to turn up positive. And as I left Minneapolis, he was waiting for his 4th test result to see now if maybe he was positive. Both Mick and Rob are heavy pot users, pot smokers. Their use of chemicals has increased dramatically since the diagnosis with AIDS. Recently, Mick has had a 20-pound weight loss in about the last 6 months. He has chronic diarrhea, so he needs to wear adult Pampers, Depends, or Attends, or whatever he calls the ones he uses. He's on some, or should be on, some experimental intravenous medication 4 times a day that he's supposed to learn to give to himself. Mick's been somebody other than pot smoking who has never taken drugs for anything. He said, "I don't take an aspirin when I have a headache, and I really don't want to deal with an IV medication 4 times a day. If I'm going to die of this anyway, I'd rather not be on this drug." I'm hard-pressed to convince him to be on it because it's an experimental drug, meaning that Food and Drug Administration has not approved it yet, and his insurance won't cover the cost of the supplies to give the drug, the cost of the nursing care to teach him how to do it, even though the drug itself comes free from the drug companies until FDA approval is gone. So it's hard for me to convince somebody who pays had to pay big money for that medication. Nick's having a very hard time eating. He has severe thrush all over his mouth. And with the diarrhea and intestinal problems from the cryptosporidium, he has a hard time keeping any food down. Because of having the diarrhea, because of extreme fatigue, and because of being unable to work, unable to eat, he's also not able to go back to work anymore. I neglected to mention Rob's parents. They're immigrants from an Eastern European country, came over in the 40s. They don't speak English, hardly at all. They don't know that their son is gay. They don't know that he lives with his partner. They live three blocks from the two of these guys, and they tend to see them quite frequently. Well, Mick has a lot of anxiety right now because his appearance is changing quite dramatically, quite quickly with the loss of weight, so that they're undergoing some struggle about when to tell the folks, what to tell the folks, and if they tell the folks, because they're close by and stop in a lot. So thinking about Mick and Rob, I'm going to just take some quick notes, but I'd like some comments about what you see in some of these realms here as the non-medical concerns these two folks are running into because of this disease.
Well, emotionally, they have an awful lot of isolation in a gay community. You didn't mention whether or not co-workers stay in touch or any of that. But
one co-worker knows, and she comes over and cooks a meal for them about once a week. She's been really terrific, and they haven't dared tell anyone, because Rob works in the same office in the Postal Service.
He said the sister knows he's gay, but not that he's ill.
Yeah.
So there's all that.
Isolation from family.
There's not only isolation, but there's an awful lot of deception that has to go on. How do we keep up appearances to all these people, far and close?
Yeah.
And just the emotional toll that takes.
We've got a raucous group next door. Excuse me.
Conflict resolution.
We have high resolve.
Okay, isolation, deception. Indeed, and both of these folks have come from families and communities that are quite tight-knit. Extended families are important and usually are checking in and doing a lot of conversation together. So that's real hard for both of them. Saw a hand over here.
I was wondering if they're going in debt because of the medical costs and all that, or?
Financial concerns are a real worry. I put that here. I have one happy story about that, and that is that the U.S. government, for its employees, has been the leader, really, in instituting policies of non-discrimination and trying to their level best to keep people working as long as possible who have AIDS. But also some of the financial benefits once they're disabled are fairly good. However, we sent in Mick's disability application, say, 6 months before he got his first check. He came to me about 3 months later and said, I'm trying to pay off all my debts. I'm trying to pay off my credit cards. I'd like to pay off my truck so my family or Mick or Rob don't have to worry about it after I die. But I need my check, and it's really slow. You ever tried calling the U.S. Postal Service Disability Claims Office? It's like Social Security or Medicare. It's a big something out there. Well, I tried and then didn't get very far, so I said, why don't you call your congressperson from Minnesota? Martin Olav Sabo is his name. He's a Norwegian. I said, it's got to be great. So he called him up, and they sent him a little form about, you know, hurry up with my disability check from the U.S. government, and he got it within 2 weeks. So it works to contact your congressperson sometimes. But yes, the financial problems were difficult. Mick also rents from Rob. Rob owns the house. Mick worries that when he doesn't have $300 a month to pay Rob for rent, that Rob's going to not be able to continue to have him there, and he's going to need another roommate. So Mick's already talked to me about what are housing options for me elsewhere in the community. So that'd be another one, longer-term care and housing for him.
It's got to be a strain on their relationship.
Mick's 34, and Rob's about 26, and he's about age 17 emotionally. He just learned English himself. He came over No, he was born here, I guess. Obviously, he was born here. It's very difficult, and they're not two people who will talk to a quote, counselor about their relationship at all. They're sticking together. That's a big deal. That doesn't always happen. Partners sometimes take off, particularly if they find out they're negative. They're out the door. Not always. They will talk to me because I'm a social worker in the hospital, and that's not a therapist. So we've been doing some conversation about how their relationship is and trying to be honest and open with their communication and their anxieties and worries and so forth.
On the spiritual one, do they belong to a church?
No, they don't. They have both. The question was, do they belong to a church? Rob grew up Catholic, Polish Catholic Church, very tight community in northeast Minneapolis. And Mick hasn't been to church probably for 15 years since he left up north. They have consented recently to meet with our chaplain at the clinic, who's pretty mellow. He's comes across talking much more clearly about spiritual issues and not religion. We talk a lot, and probably will over the next few sessions, about what's happened with the church and people who are intravenous drug users or gay or bisexual folks. So that's been very difficult. One phenomenon I was describing to somebody earlier is that more and more people with AIDS are outliving their initial expectation for life. They're a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years post-diagnosis with AIDS. I've had several of them say to me, now what? I feel pretty good. I have AIDS, I should have died a year ago. I've written my will, I've gotten my disability check, my family all knows. Now what? Why am I living? What is the purpose? That is strictly, in my book, a spiritual concern that comes out after all the business is sort of taken care of by a number of these folks. That's beyond my expertise at the moment to say to them, well, this is what you do and this is what your life means, but that the spiritual concerns are real grave for these people. Yeah.
About psychological concerns with people who have been independent and self-supporting for quite a while that now become dependent on other people or outside sources to keep them going.
Dependency is a very big one. That's very good. And you touch on loss anyway, loss of independence, and loss sort of overwhelms all of the psychological arena. From the seemingly minute loss of body image, people, all of us, I was just telling Judy Madison, I don't have a mirror in my chalet, in my room. I can hardly get ready without a mirror. You know, all of us have an image of how we want to look and need to look. Well, imagine being covered with lesions, the Kaposi sarcoma cancer that's very common in people with AIDS, or big black or purplish lesions that can be anywhere in the body, or wasting away, losing 30% of your body weight. A lot of these folks, when they die, look extremely cachectic and like people from the concentration camps. Just that loss, adding to that the loss of their futures, the loss of family or friends, the loss of a sense of touch. All of us thrive on physical touch with people, hugs or caresses or an arm on the shoulder or, you know, a pat on the back or something. Folks with AIDS lose a lot of that in their lives. They lose their own way to express their sexuality. Whatever big sort of definition we get about sexual definition, much of that is lost in the process. So a lot of deep psychological stuff that goes on.
I had an experience with a man who was almost dead of AIDS in the hospital, and I went to see him. He had left the church probably 10 years ago when he decided that he didn't have a choice about his sexuality. And when I visited him, the first thing he said is, I've been praying to the God of my childhood. Mm-hmm. And I'd never considered what that meant. Mm-hmm. And then I said, the God of your child? He said, my mother's God. And so I said, well, then let's pray to that God, if that's the God who hears your prayers. Because then the God who becomes harsher, I guess, is the adult God who does not allow him to mature into a sexual human being. And so in working with that in the spiritual realm, I don't know how to describe that except maybe
whoever God is.
Whoever, yeah.
That's a very poignant example, I think. People have very diverse and creative images of God, and I realize the fairly narrow image of God I grew up with as a Lutheran pastor's daughter, and I'm proud to be a Lutheran pastor's daughter and a Lutheran, but I've learned a lot. I have just a quick, funny story about that. I learn something every day from these folks, but I asked one person when I was assessing his psychosocial needs as a social worker, I said to him, so do you consider yourself a spiritual being, which is how I usually ask the question. And he said, well, yeah, I'm Wiccan. Who knows what Wiccan is here? A couple people. I said, Wiccan? I'm in Minneapolis. What's Wiccan? So he said, well, it's the old witches. And when I met him, he'd been diagnosed that day, and it was March 21st. And he said he was extremely depressed because people who follow Wiccan celebrate the vernal equinox with a big party and celebration. So he was about 60 miles from home where his group of folks were going to gather that night, and he was feeling a little depressed. So I said, well, why don't we get them up here and have a party in your room? And he just said, no, we're going to have a party in my room. So we had a party in his room, and he was delighted to be able to be with his spiritual support folks. But that opened my eyes a little bit. Wickedness. Okay, we have a few that are untouched here. Don't be scared. Ethical, moral. What about that?
Mary, on the ethical side, wouldn't Nick feel an obligation to terminate his relationship with Rev since he is testing negative?
What does anybody else have to say about that one? Not that I don't want to answer it. I haven't answered it.
The sexual relationship or the relationship?
Well, the sexual side of it is the part that's going to hurt Rev. I mean, I think if he really cared for him, he would have terminated.
Maybe they could be making changes under the behavioral portion, you know, changing the way they have safe sex, they act intimately with each other.
Yep, they've both been very open to asking what's okay and what's not okay. We've had, with the physician too, some very, very good conversations about that. And actually, they've been safe for about a year and a half. They haven't been having any intercourse. They haven't even done protected intercourse. They've been really careful about that because Mick started feeling pretty sick at one point before he even tested. And he said, I have a real worry. So they were real careful about that. Mick keeps saying, I just don't think I should stick around. I think maybe you can't deal with this, and I don't want to burden you. You're only 27. You've got your whole life to live. And Rob says, we made a commitment, and I'm here as long as you're here. And whatever our relationship is, that's what it'll be. It's true, and I'm sure many of you have experienced sort of in the ups and downs of your relationships, too, when emotion and anxiety and worry is very high, as it is with folks in this situation or in lots of situations of illness. The sexual appetite and drive reduces a lot also. And that's true for a lot of these folks, although the difficulty arises when one partner is not feeling as sexual as the other one might be. But some behavioral changes will certainly be needed for these two.
Has Mitt been suicidal at all in his refusal to take experimental drugs? Indication that
people hear that question, whether Mick's been suicidal or not? Does the refusal to take those medications sort of indicate that he wants to end his life prematurely, if that's how we define suicide?
He may just wish to die with dignity and perhaps feel that the medication may have side effects we haven't discussed here that he's not willing to put up with.
We're going to do a forum later, or a session later in the week on the ethical and moral dilemmas that arise with AIDS. Suicide is a very, very big one. It is the toughest one for me. In this particular case, I had no problem with him saying he didn't want that drug. It was a very nasty drug, had some nasty side effects anyway. He was feeling pretty good at the time. There's no guarantee it would work. He said, if I have 2 weeks where I can be out and about doing what I want to do and get up in the morning out of bed and die in 2 weeks, I'd rather do that than be confined to my house, worry about injecting myself 4 times a day, and live 2 months. So I would not call him suicidal, and he hasn't been, in my opinion, suicidal to this point.
doesn't mean he won't become that at some point. But the decision to not treat or not take treatments that are available is an increasingly difficult one in this whole society with AIDS or with other diseases, and we'll talk more about that later in the week. It's okay, go ahead.
I work in New York, and I read an article that just sort of startled me at one point about AIDS, in that some funeral directors will not accept an AIDS victim. And they finally found a few that will, and then the conflict where the parents might not allow the lover to take part, and even the funeral itself gets to be a problem. But I hadn't realized that some funeral directors said no.
Sort of confronts our sensibilities, doesn't it, as people? In Minnesota, it's illegal for a funeral home to refuse, but it happens all the time. People call, you know, one home will call another one and say, we're not going to take this body, can you do it? And they'll ship them somewhere else. It's really awful. The situation where a parent blocks out a lover or partner from making any of the arrangements happens all the time. And that would be a continuing struggle, I think. And that has to do with recognition of a gay relationship as being a family relationship and a committed relationship. The way we have sort of watched that and enabled that to not be as big a problem is right away when people come into our clinic and they're testing positive, as soon as we feel they're sort of ready to talk about some of the longer-term issues, we say it's important that you realize who your legal next of kin is. And I say to a 48-year-old man, who do you think your legal next of kin is? And it's your mother. She's 82. She lives in Iowa. He looks at me shocked. I said, my mother's my legal next of kin. For single people, our parents, if they're living, are legal next of kin. If they're not living, our brothers and sisters are legal next of kin. Some of these folks have not talked to parents or brothers or sisters for 15 years. So different states are enacting some different kind of legislations, well, not only states, but municipalities, about that, ways that people can make a partner or a friend that significant person to make those arrangements. But that has to be done early on. It has to be done when people are competent and feeling pretty good. So
can they put them down as beneficiaries on life insurance policy?
Sure. You can put anybody down you want. Yep, I'm writing power of attorney here and wills. We do a whole session on some of the legal aspects. Probably better to have a lawyer sometimes, but that comes up all the time.
Yeah. Just point of fact, with the funeral situation, is there a contagion, infectious possibility by, is it embalming? Is that what the issue
embalming is the worry.
And is there a reason to worry?
There's no known reason to worry. The virus dies when the body dies. However, all funeral homes, in our state at least, have been told to follow universal precautions, and that is glove when they're in contact with any of the bodily fluids. Some are double gloving, which is overly cautious. But all the scientific people I talked to about that, including the head of the funeral mortuary science program at the University of Minnesota, said there's absolutely no reason to worry about that. That doesn't mean they're not going to worry about it.
Are they told that someone is?
In our state, and I think it's true in most states, AIDS is supposed to be put on a death certificate. The true cause of death needs to be put on a death certificate. Early on especially, doctors were doing all sorts of doctoring of death certificates, writing pneumonia or writing cancer or something. They're really supposed to write AIDS. But when a body is released from a hospital, for instance, from our intensive care unit or one of the other units, the nurse or the physician releasing the body to the mortician only has to say this person died of an infectious disease. So we must say the person died of an infectious thing. We don't have to say AIDS. They usually figure it out if the person's 22 years old. And I don't know. So it gets around it. They don't have to know. But it is a matter of public record once it's on a death certificate. What somebody died of, anyone can go look it up.
I was reminded on the ethical moral is this friend who died of AIDS, his dad kept saying, well, you chose a slow suicide, that there was this combination of grief and anger in the father who couldn't figure out why this guy would choose a gay life and then contract AIDS on purpose, kind of.
We all need to blame somebody at some point when we're angry about something. Often we're blaming the people with the disease itself. It's their own fault. And there certainly is a long tradition in our Judeo-Christian background that people used to believe that sin resulted in disease, or that it was God's punishment for disease. There's a lot of that still very, very prevalent in many of us. And this is where it comes out frequently.
I imagine as a social worker, you're working with him a lot, and his feelings about his family, his mother, and his, you said his father's dead?
Father died, right.
But his sisters and brothers that don't know about it, has he rejected that family? Or?
No, he's very traumatized about that. He does not want them to figure out or hear later that he died of AIDS. He wants to tell them. And that's probably, next to suicide, probably the hardest thing I do with people is talk through who to tell, what, how much, when. Because the timing, the information given, how it's given, where it's given, is all extremely critical. A lot of these folks, as you know, in Minnesota, 90% of them are also gay or bisexual, and a good number of them don't have families who know that. So that's the first thing that needs to be talked about. People often ask me, I should tell them, shouldn't I? Or do you think I should tell them? And I never answer that yes or no, of course. What I usually say is, trust yourself to tell them when it's right to tell them. But let's talk about some of the ramifications of not telling them, and of telling them, and of when you tell them, and how you tell them, and who's around when you tell them. I've been in a lot of family meetings when the diagnosis is told. I have never myself told somebody in the family for the person with AIDS. I always encourage that person to say it. The one thing I found, both in working in oncology, or with people with cancer and with people with AIDS, is that one thing many of us don't think about is one of the first reactions I get is, oh, I could never tell my mother she has a heart condition. I'd cause her death. She got a cardiac arrest. Or I could never tell my sister she's pregnant. She'd miscarry. People get into a very deep protection mode, which is, you know, I need to protect my loved ones from this terrible thing. They're going to worry about me. They're going to, you know, have their own problems. Well, that may be true. They may worry. They may have some angina because of some of the anxiety about it. But what I talk with them about is, more often than not, what I found in my practice is, over years, a mother will come to me down the road and say, why didn't he trust me earlier? I feel alienated. I feel rejected. I feel he did not believe I loved him enough to tell me. And he didn't trust me enough to tell me. And the hurt and the sadness and grief there is much deeper than what I've seen over time when people are told prematurely, which can be nasty, it can be icky, but they get over it better than people who feel that deep sense of not being trusted. So I point that out to people, and they kind of say, well, you know, I kind of think she suspects it anyway. I say, well, why do you think that? Well, for one thing, she hasn't asked me for 5 years why I didn't bring a girl home. For another, every time she calls, she says, are you feeling okay? You're looking kind of weak. You sound kind of tired. And she's always asking me. She never used to ask me. So I tend to say, usually, unless family members have their heads really deep in the sand, or live, and I'm going to pick a state where they might live and not know about AIDS, or not see a Newsweek, people usually suspect something at some point. And I bet a lot of you would have some experience with that. So that's true. But that's a tough, tough, tough process. It's really a second coming out, if you will. The people who've come out already to their families and said, I'm gay, I've been gay for 30 years, and they know it, and this guy's 50 years old. It's a whole new process of coming out as someone with this disease. So that's a tough one. Everybody ignored social. Is that because I'm a social worker?
I think the social is family, too.
Social is family, social support systems. My example about social is that, as you know, compared to a lot of these other things, it's not as heavy duty, but if any one of us in this room, maybe except retired folks, imagine tomorrow that we couldn't be a garbologist, or we couldn't be a waitry, or we couldn't go back to our jobs, or couldn't go to school, and we stayed home, and even if we had the community of Holden Village, or our family, or our roommates, or our spouse who loved us and cared about us, they're gone 8 hours a day. 10 hours a day if they commute. That's a lot of alone time. It's a lot of alone time where somebody can't really do the things he or she wants to be doing during the day. Still has a pretty good support system, but gets extremely isolated, as Julia talked about. Becomes withdrawn sometimes, and it's real critical that we look for ways for people to continue to feel like they're active and helpful parts of society and able to contribute. We had one guy with AIDS who was still feeling pretty good, but he was a fourth grade teacher and he just couldn't hold up to teaching. He had a huge, lovely golden retriever. And he asked me if he could be doing some volunteer work, and so we hooked him up on taking the dog to the nursing home about 3 blocks from his house. He could walk 3 blocks at that time. So he was doing that a couple times a week and got a tremendous amount of joy visiting those older folks, something he'd never done in his life. Something fairly minor, it seems, but extremely major for these folks. It's close to time to quit here, but any final thoughts or concerns or something that we can make sure we address later in the week?
Are there any concerns about previous experts?
As in, do they know or are they positive or how many do not have to be sick? Informing them, yeah. States vary a lot about that, but inevitably, when someone comes into our clinic, the doctor talks with them about previous sexual contacts or anybody they might have shared IV drugs with and says it really is your responsibility to contact those people. If you don't want to or can't, the public health authorities will do that. The sexual transmitted diseases investigators are used to that kind of discussion with sexual contacts, and they can do that anonymously. Give them names, they'll call up and say, we've been told that you might have been exposed to the HIV and we suggest you to see your doctor about that or something. But it's definitely a concern. And a lot of these folks can name several people that they might have infected. And most of them that I've worked with have told those people. Most of them have. Yeah.
Are you going to have a section on some of the societal economic impact?
I'm not alone, but I can tell you one pretty scary statistic, and that is that in the next 2 years, AIDS will be the number one killer of men in Minnesota between 25 and 44, and the public health folks look at a category called Years of Potential Life Lost, YPPL. It's an economic indicator that if we look at people between the ages of 25 and 44, these are folks who have between 21 and 40. No, something, anyway. Lots of years left to be contributing to our society. And if you multiply the amount of money those people were making and perhaps spending in our society times that many years, we're talking about a major economic impact for our whole country and the world. And in many countries in Africa, up to 50% of the people in certain parts of the country, certain cities, have been infected with HIV. And these are folks between probably 18 and 40. These are people who would normally be growing up and maturing to be leading those countries, to be the business people, to be the economic backbone of the countries, and half of those populations will be wiped out. So I think the economic impact globally is also dramatic.
I guess I'm referring to the choices that the society has to make and where it puts its health care and social care dollars. And the one thing that I have a real hard time, and I think it doesn't become compassionate to say this, but let me just throw it out there because I know it's out there. Is there a lot of good places to put our healthcare dollars? And I have a hard time with the choices that need to be made and where they go and where they don't go. And I would like to spend some time on that.
Yeah, well, I think we can make a point when we do the ethical stuff to talk about that because people have real strong opinions. And my opinion is thus far nobody's making the choices that have to be made in the whole country. But you're right. I mean, it's out there and we need to talk about it. And we can. If I don't bring it up and I'll try to work it in, bring it up Thursday, I think it is. Thursday or Friday, yeah. Thanks, all. I have some materials up here. Anybody wants to look at